Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by betonline.ag. NFL Week 4 Monday Night Football on the docket, but before we get to the big game, I am, of course, your host and fearless leader, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
What's going on?
Not much, man. Another NFL week, another NFL winner. It was good to go back to our roots with a first half under, and even more gratifying, Payne, when we go first half under and the full game goes over.
Yeah, that is always nice, but I won't gloat too much because it wasn't the best of weekends. It was one of those, and I knew coming in, it was just a weird board. It was a weird card. A lot of stuff didn't line up. Dogs have been cashing at just a crazy clip, and it's like, man, I'm going to play defense this weekend, and thank God I did because it was ugly for a lot of groups.
You know what? It's one of those things that survive in advance. And I know you do a lot of media. I do a ton of stuff where people go, oh, can we get your best bet or your three best bets? And trying to explain to them that sometimes you can't force things that aren't on the card. You just have to know, and quote the great Kenny Rogers, you have to know when to hold them. You have to know when to fold them. And you have to know when to walk away. You need to know when to run. And weekends like this come around a couple times throughout the course of football season. And the more you do this, the faster you can identify that these are the spots that you just want to try and play a little small ball instead of trying to hit the grand slam.
Kenny Rogers, is that the chicken guy or the country music singer?
That is the country music singer. It's not the former Yankee starter as the Major League Baseball playoffs loom closer. And I will not have an investment in Kenny Rogers Roasters anytime soon like Kramer.
What was the chicken place in Seinfeld? I'm having a brain fart right now.
Wasn't it Kenny Rogers Roasters or something like that when they had the red light there and Kramer and Jerry are trying to fight for the apartment?
Yeah, I thought so.
I mean, I feel like that's perfect, though, because we did get a Rochelle reference in the 49ers-Chargers game that was trending all over Twitter. So despite the fact Seinfeld hasn't produced a new episode in years and years, it lives on and will continue to do so as an iconic television program.
I'm not really on Twitter during games, but that's funny that that broke out because I heard the Rochelle mention, and I know you had the Chargers fantasy defense this weekend, so it would have been nice if he lumbered his way into the end zone there for you.
You know what? I haven't had a good fantasy defense yet this season. I do have a marquee player going tonight as I take on a media mogul I'd love to take down. So Emmanuel Sanders, if you're out there listening, come on, let's get to the end zone once. Let's put a few catches on the board and be able to make things happen. But enough about fantasy. No one gives a shit about what I'm doing in that regard. We have some games to discuss that took place over the weekend. And of course, what appears, Payne, is going to be a Monday fixture given the positive outpouring of support. Dr. Chow will be with us every Monday during the NFL regular season, kind of recapping the biggest injuries and what they mean for your sports betting and fantasy going forward.
Yeah, he's been fantastic so far. Everyone wanted him back, and now you got him. So every Monday he'll join us. We'll talk about the biggest injuries, their impact on the look on the week ahead. So I think that's crucial, especially Monday morning, right? Getting the information before everybody else, that's vital, and you can certainly use it, and it's actionable for the week ahead.
And you can, of course, follow him at Pro Football Doc. You can follow me at Todd Furman and Payne at Payne Insider. Thank you to all those that have gone to iTunes. They've offered up their 5-star reviews. Those continue to pile up and allowing to do us special things. Promotions in the works, as Payne has mentioned, but I won't bog you down with those details. We'll revisit it on a Thursday. So, Payne, let's start with what we saw last, and that, of course, the Sunday night football game where it's a broken record. The Steelers seem to dribble down their leg every chance they have against some of these divisional foes when they get outcoached.
We weren't going to talk about it, but I see how you lined me up there. I appreciate that.
I mean, I have, you know, people wanted a Tomlin rant. I don't know if we were going to get one of those epic Tomlin rants, but I need at least a little bit of a jab here and there.
There doesn't need to be a rant, right? Like, how many humans are on planet Earth right now? And he has a job where there's only 32 of them in the entire world. It's mind-boggling. You know, when you look at the adjustments at halftime, there were none.
What adjustments?
There were none. I mean, 23 second half offensive snaps for Big Ben. and Pittsburgh was held to just 2 yards per play. And so, you know, I think we give credit to that Baltimore defense. You know, Don Martindale, I think he's been exceptional so far. Jimmy Smith is on the way back, so that's huge. And, you know, this felt like, to me, Baltimore taking that next step, because we knew coming in the metrics looked pretty good. They were number one in passing success rate defense. They were third in explosive passes allowed. But you could kind of paint it as, you know, they played Nathan Peterman, they played Josh Allen, Andy Dalton, Case Keenum. Sunday night, the Ravens faced a real deal offense on the road. There weren't bad weather conditions, and I think we can now see that this is an elite Baltimore defense with a better offense, and I like where we're sitting at over 8 wins on that win total.
I'm definitely right there with you. Love what I saw, not only on the defensive side, but offensively. Getting a cast of characters involved. John Brown's ability to take the lid off the defense, something that they've desperately lacked. Michael Crabtree and Willie Snead starting to come into their own. And just getting the tight ends and running backs in there. I think it's a wealth of riches for the Ravens and a team we'll have our eye on going forward, as you mentioned, that win total. But Payne, from a coach that I know you disdain in Mike Tomlin to probably your ultimate man crush in the NFL, I know it happened on Thursday, but my Lord, when you average 10.1 yards per play in the National Football League, you deserve every single possible accolade heaped on your shoulders.
And he's got fantastic scruff level, too. I mean, the scruff is outstanding for McVay. He's got the Hollywood girlfriend. I mean, it's everything. He's living life right now. And I don't want to go too far into him because we said what was coming Thursday night before the fact. You know, I don't want to talk about it too much after the fact. This is a business where you got to talk about it before the fact. And now this is 12 of 20 games with 30 or more points for McVay. 64% of the Rams offensive plays graded successful. Jared Goff gave a big middle finger to everyone that called him a system quarterback.
Not to be confused with the middle finger that Earl Thomas gave to the Seahawks, but continue.
That was awesome, by the way. I mean, that's my kind of guy. You know, McVay exploited the matchups. The first two touchdowns, Gurley on Anthony Barr in space, Cooper Kupp on Anthony Barr in space. The Vikings defense, if you watch the film in the All-22, in recent times, they have had trouble stopping exotic offenses.
Yeah, I mean, when you go through some of this stuff and you try and figure out, Payne, how these teams are going to unfold, I mean, who stops the Rams?
You're going to have to score some points, and the defense is a little beat up and it's a little thin. So if you have an offensive line that can somewhat stalemate their defensive line, you're going to have a shot to make some plays. I thought the Vikings offensive line held their own, and there were a couple situations where I think they did better and they might not get credit for it. I mean, Kirk Cousins, you got to have some pocket presence, brother. Step up into the pocket. A couple of those issues were hit, well, totally on the quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, and the Vikings, an interesting game against Philadelphia, one we'll preview in greater detail, a rematch from the NFC Championship, that, of course, coming up on Thursday. The Bears, Payne, they actually look like a living, breathing, competent offense. Mitchell Trubisky, a career-high
six touchdown
passes.
He was playing like Mike the first few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, 344 yards in the air. I blinked, and that game was 21-3.
Listen, I'm not going to discredit the Bears. It was the best game of Trubisky's career. I think he had, when I'm looking at this right now, the sheet, 12.7 yards per pass attempt, 67% of passes, great, successful. But for me, it's like, boy, oh boy. Like, all we heard for the last month, whether it was openly, whether it was discreetly, you know, reading between the lines, was Tampa players love Fitzpatrick. You got to ride the hot hand. And in a game where I think you could have ensured Fitz magic continuing, you no show for the guy. Like Tampa Bay, that was the worst performance I've seen from any of the 32 teams through 4 weeks. They didn't get off the team plane.
Yeah, I mean, it looked bad right from the opening snap, and clearly this is now Jameis Winston's team, maybe by no fault of Fitzpatrick's own. But what I will say is, for those of us sitting on an under 6.5 win total for the Bucs, what looked to be dire initially, all of a sudden I have some renewed confidence that this may still very well become the same old Tampa Bay Bucs. Mike Vrabel, Payne, making an outstanding coaching decision, in my opinion, foregoing the field goal late. You seem to indicate to me over text you thought it was a no-brainer for him playing for the
clause.
Win.
I liked the clause before the question. And I knew when we went back and forth on text that you would ask me about this. Who plays for ties? And I get it. Just because
European soccer clubs?
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, just because, like, the majority of coaches that we watch, like, punt on 4th-and-4 from the opponent 39-yard line, doesn't mean we got to start giving out, like, pats on the back for doing things correctly. situationally and mathematically. It was 4th and 2 at the Philly 33, and so the field goal would have been 50 yards. And when you look at some of the data, 50-yard field goals, they have about a 63% make rate in the league. I had one of my guys dig into this because I knew you were going to ask me about this. So based on the percentage of field goals made from 50 to 54 yards and the percentage of times you make it on fourth down, your break-even point for choosing to go for it or kick the field goal is roughly like 4th and 5. So at about 5 yards in that situation from the 33, it's like mathematically a coin flip. At 4th and 6 from the 33, history slightly leans towards taking the field goal. At 4th and 5, again, coin flip, 4th and 4 or less, strongly suggests you should be going for it. So, you know, you rub elbows with Belichick for long enough, I'm sure he made him happy by going for it on a 4th and 2.
So that's with any kicker not named Justin Tucker, as you allude to some
it's
of those
across
metrics,
the board.
Correct?
So Tucker's included in that number, but certainly Tucker's the very best. So if you excluded him from it, might make even more of a case for going for it.
Absolutely crazy. I mean, the amount of analytics stuff there. And I have to give them the folks at NBC credit as well for the way on Sunday night, last night during the Ravens and Steelers game, they showed the win probabilities going on it for 4th and short when the Ravens elected to do something similar from plus territory. I think it was either 41 or the 38, somewhere along those lines. So it's good to see some of those things start to slide in the telecast and getting people thinking differently. But I've shared enough about what I thought was good. I know you watch the games intently and have an eye on everything that's taking place. What jumped off the page for you yesterday in a positive
direction?
Well,
was interesting was Alvin Kamara, and I know a lot of sharp guys had an interest in that total. So big run at the end there.
There was good two on that total. There was good two-way, if I remember correctly. I know the game got bet over, and then we saw some under money come in
so
as well.
So initially, the real position was over 50.5. And listen, like to a lot of people out there, like beating the market's awesome. And I know a lot of people track that kind of thing, but when you're the ones that have influence and can beat the market, like it's not something that like it's awesome to have, but when you track it, like it just, you know, doesn't make any sense. But there's more than one group out there and there's going to be a difference of opinion. So initially over 50.5, extremely sharp. Once it got to 53, there was a wave of under money and I saw it hang there around like 51, 51.5, I believe. So that run for the initial group, which I tend to lean with a little bit more. Enjoyed that run. And listen, Kamara was awesome. But I think like when you look at him in 2018, like that's your prototypical back. But what he did yesterday, he got it done between the tackles. 68% of his runs graded successful. He handled the increased workload. We thought maybe Gillisley would get some of that. Nope. So he had 19 carries between the tackles, 2 explosive runs. And then you look at what he's doing in the pass game. Like you come to expect that at this point. But he had 9 targets. The next closest receiver was Michael Thomas with only 4. So yesterday was just a 2-man show in New York. It was Breeze and it was Kamara.
You know what? Yesterday he ran like Payne, a man who knows Mark Ingram's coming back from suspension and wants to prove that he can also be a between the tackles
man, I
runner.
I think that makes them a little bit more dynamic. It just gives them a different feel, a different vibe. There's going to be games where you need that. Listen, a lot of times, like when you're in the back alley with a bunch of friends, you need that one guy who's willing to take the first punch and absorb the first punch. Like Mark Ingram is that dude for this offense. And right now, I know they've gotten off to a good start. The offense has been electric, but there are going to be games where you need Mark Ingram.
Oh, for sure. And you can line both of those guys up out there and force defenses to respect both of them and the potential to run between the tackles. It's going to open a bevy of play calling options. And as we saw in the past, the Saints start slow. The first two games start to come in their own. And of course, a game this time next week we'll preview in great detail when they play host to the Washington Redskins. This is about a touchdown favorite in that matchup. But Payne, as we know, every week with the good comes the bad. And I wanted to, I don't know, ever like to really pick on the officials, but I watched that Browns game closely. And I, of course, take my shots at Cleveland like I do every single week on social media. I didn't see enough video evidence, and I'm not sure if you watch it, for them to overturn that call on the field and ultimately give the Raiders the lifeline they needed to getting their first victory.
Yeah, tough call for sure. But don't give up 45 points, then blame somebody else. That feels like a 2018 move. From someone that's uber soft. Like you blew a 2-touchdown lead late in the third quarter against a team that's been like wilting like an ice cream cone in late summer, like every game this year. And you blew it. You're up 14 with the ball and you just handed it over to Oakland. I think they started, they had the 1st and goal from the 7 off the fumble. This is just what the Browns do at this point. Like you got to get over the mental hurdle. And you know, the sad thing is like certainly Cleveland looks more competent and this week could be a decent spot. But like when you look at their overall opportunity through the first four games, at one point throughout each of the four, Cleveland was favored to win during live wagering, and it's yielded just one victory. So at this point, like, you got to get over that mental hump and figure out how to win, and blowing two touchdown leads with the ball late in the game, like, you just can't do that. And I'm not going to blame anybody for, you know, blame the ref on why I'm inept.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You have to take accountability and own your actions. The Browns had plenty of chances to control their own fate in that game. Like you said, you score 40-plus on the road with a first-year quarterback. You should win that game 99.9% of the time. What other things really disappointed you? I mean, I know we touched on the Bucs' defense and not getting off the plane against the Bears, but what were some of the other things you saw from Week 4 that really surprised you in a negative fashion?
I think it's the Dolphins, right? Like, the offense was brutal. And I get Tannehill had led the league in, you know, screen yards and short passing yards, and it really looked like that New England defense was squatting. They game plan and said, hey, we're going to take the run away, we're going to take the short passing game away, and we're going to make Tannehill beat us. And the defense for New England had off to them, like, you know, they were fantastic, but this offense was brutal. 3.8 yards per play, 24% of plays were successful on offense. And for me, it was like the internal talk. Like, there's not going to be a letdown here. This is a turning point for the future. Like, it's going to be a changing of the guard, and they just flat out no-showed.
Yeah, same old Dolphins on the road at Gillette. I mean, it's been a house of horrors for them. You figured New England was going to play a chip on their shoulder, knowing that the Dolphins could potentially distance themselves with an outright win. But New England, like they've done the previous three times where they'd lost back-to-back games, end up winning by 20-plus. Simply incredible for a team. Every time you think they have one foot in the grave, like some of the media folks, New England shows why they are the preeminent franchise in the National
that
Football
League.
That
was the handicapping angle, right? And this was what always, and I didn't want to cut you off there, but I think this is always
a
good debate, and it comes with the handicapping, and it's why I think you have to mix a little bit in. But it's like, I never want to get into that, and no long-term professional bettor does. It's like, I want to get into that spot. Well, hey, you know, like the last 12, 15 years, every time that the Patriots do lose two games in a row, they're an automatic win the next game. Like, you know, you got to kind of refocus into the now. You have to look at the matchups, the X's and O's. Certainly there is a situational advantage there for New England, but like, if that's all you're basing your handicapping on, sure, you got the win here, but you're just not going to be a successful long-term bettor doing that stuff. Like, you know, the metrics do matter. The X's and O's matter. The current matters. Now, blowout winner if you laid it with New England, but you're not going to win long-term doing that.
No, and I think we've seen on a lot of levels markets respond to it, because I saw a lot of discourse the same way on Thursday night for the Vikings and Rams. Oh, the Vikings are a good football team. They're automatically going to bounce back. I think that becomes a dangerous, dangerous game to play if you're looking to try and use that to handicap without digging in. And you talked about it. Current form and what you have on the field and what you have going now past history isn't indicative of future success.
Yeah, without question. Now, you got an all-in effort. The matchup was good. Once Josh Sitton went down, certainly the Dolphins have struggled to run the ball a little bit. That's the one positive New England has going for it. They can stop the run. They got Trey Flowers back. You get Patrick Chung, the box safety, back. The Dolphins couldn't run the ball. And so the game plan was very good. And again, for whatever reason, the Dolphins still can't stop running back passes or tight ends. I mean, it's the same thing over and over. So New England's always had success moving the ball on them, especially in Gillette. It's been a house of horrors, and I get that. Didn't play the game, fortunately, but I do know there was sharp money on the Dolphins this week at 7. It's why it was 6.5. And despite, I remember Dave Mason saying it was the largest liability of the day, they still didn't go to 7.
Yeah, I mean, there had to be some money and an appetite for the dog there, but clearly we're not rewarded with some of their faith in the Dolphins. But you mentioned their struggles, Payne, and I look at the overall ugliness of offenses in the AFC East not named the New England Patriots. The Bills' offense, 145 yards, a robust 2.6 yards per play, and at one point Josh Allen was 3 for 15, finished the game with 87 yards passing. And the Jets, they apparently were offensive wizards, 178 yards. They averaged 3.5 yards per play, minus 13 in first downs, and ran 23 less offensive plays than the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Josh Allen, zapped back into reality a little bit there. That was ugly.
we put in Buffalo on the clock to draft another quarterback, number one overall next season.
Man, I don't know. He wasn't accurate in college. He's still not accurate here. I get how they looked against Minnesota, but Minnesota's defense has been a little lackluster. There were some short fields there. I think this might be a little bit scarier and more indicative of the Vikings defense, which scares me. You know, I don't know what Josh Allen is at this point. It's not good, though. Sam Darnold struggled a little bit, 3.9 yards per pass attempt. We're seeing a bit of the, I don't want to call it the rookie wall yet, but there's tape on him. And listen, that was a bad spot. Like, this was a Jacksonville defense that, one, is very good, but two, they're a little pissed off after last week. So it was a tough spot there. Interesting money back and forth last week on that game. You had this very sophisticated teaser group. Virtually every teaser was tied into the Jaguars, but there was sharp money plus the points on the Jets. They just couldn't move the ball at all. It wasn't just Darnold, but he's struggling right now.
Yeah, I mean, from what you've seen from Darnold, what does he have to do to turn the corner? I mean, for my untrained eye, I look at it, and the fact that he can't connect with the Jets' best receiver, at least last season, and Robbie Anderson, somewhat troublesome, and they haven't been able to run the football at all to create any semblance of balance. Hopefully, they'll get back on track this week when they get the Denver Broncos, who will come in there after a short
offense
week.
Offense has not been great, can't run the ball, can't hit Robbie Anderson. They're on just two different wavelengths. Quincy Enunwa was basically his guy, but he's been an underneath route runner, so there's not much explosion there. I don't love what we're seeing right now from Darnold and this Jets offense, but maybe they get a little healthier in a better spot next week against Denver, as you alluded to.
Yeah, defense, it's a little slightly more manageable. They won't have the short week and some of those other potential deterrents there. But from the good, the bad, and the ugly pain, we obviously see market overreaction. And as we do here every Monday on the Bet the Board podcast, look ahead adjustments and how the market has adapted based on 1 week's worth of results. Surprisingly, there were only three games that jumped off the page that I felt were noteworthy and worth talking about. And we can start in Orchard Park, New York, with the aforementioned Bills, who find themselves now 3.5-point underdogs on the current line at betonline.ag, a change from -3, where the look-ahead number was at the Westgate Superbook earlier. When you look at Tennessee, Payne, they, of course, have a big win against Philadelphia, erase a 17-3 deficit. Some injuries, though, on the defensive side. Kenny Vaccaro and Wesley Woodyard weren't able to finish. I mean, is this the kind of number you feel is a fair reflection more so of the Bills' struggles, or Tennessee starting to show a little bit more than we expected?
I would think the latter. Now, the number is pretty telling to me. I'm going to be interested to hear what Dr. Chow thought of Mariota's performance. You know, he did have that 14-for-14 stretch late in the game. And we did see the sharpest guys in the world just have no issues investing in the Titans this past week, right? They took that game from 4 down to soft 3. So I think they're a team where we're not just disregarding them now. Like, if serious professional bettors are okay investing in Mariota, I think you at least have to continue to consider their games. But, when you look at the Titans, I just don't think there's going to be, right now, serious concerns for just avoiding the Titans altogether. Now, this isn't a great spot, obviously. And Mariota certainly has some limitations regardless of what you saw. But it's still a team that you probably are considering. You're not just disregarding them altogether right now.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how things unfold, both those teams. Buffalo has shown some resiliency. They'll have their hands full with the Titans defense. It's a little bit underrated. When I look at the other game, Payne, that jumps off for me, the 49ers, I mean, this is a team right now that still trying to figure out its identity with C.J. Beathard. Currently a 4.5-point favorite playing host to Arizona at betonline.ag. On the look-ahead number, San Francisco was a modest 2.5-point chalk. I watched both of those games. I didn't see that much to change here to have it go through not one key number at 3, but 2 at 4.
I concur. I saw the reopen of 5, 5.5. Didn't last long. Certainly C.J. Beathard looked somewhat competent. And that great pass to Greg Kittle. When I say great pass, that was a little facetious. Like, it was a wobbling duck. But Greg Kittle turned it into an explosive play. And you get that first game, Jimmy G's out, and we're going to just attack the world. We're going to be fine. They may well be, but this number's a little high right now, I would think.
Yeah, I would tend to concur with you on that. I'm not sure it's a game, though, that will grace our fine podcast on Thursday. And then I look at the Battle of Texas on Sunday night, Payne. Look-ahead number here had the Texans a 4.5-point favorite. Right now at betonline.ag, we see the Texans -3, albeit juice trending towards 3.5. And I ask you this, I mean, the Texans had such lofty expectations coming into the season, and I was ready to rip them on this podcast had they squandered a 28-10 lead against the Colts. I don't even know what to do with Houston. Dallas at least showed some semblance of life, and a hat tip to Ezekiel Elliott for a career-high 240 yards with what he meant running and catching. But this now all of a sudden an intriguing game, because with a win, Dallas suddenly is 3-2 and very much back, not alive to win the NFC, but at least worth discussing.
It feels like a must-win for both teams at this point. And, you know, the Texans got out pretty good. Defense wilted late with Andrew Luck playing catch-up. And I'm not a huge fan of that Texans defense right now, especially in the secondary. They did take advantage, at least up front, of a beat-up Colts offensive line that's still missing Anthony Costanzo. But aside from that, once they went to the quick pass game and the Colts were forced to play catch-up, they did basically whatever they wanted. I know Frank Reich's getting his nuts busted for the decision. I'm an aggressive guy. Go for it. I like that decision. But when you look at this game, it's going to be an all-in effort from both teams. I think if you drop to 1-4, the Texans season's just about done. So it's just as meaningful to them as it is for Dallas. I didn't watch the Dallas game. I'm going to go back. It's going to be one of the first games I watch today. Certainly they were able to run the ball, which everyone's been able to do against the Lions. Will that be the case this week? Dak's going to be able to, he's going to have to take advantage of that Texans secondary. Let's see if he can.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about it, Dak did do a good job of spreading it around. The key upgraded status was Cole Beasley, who's become kind of his new Jason Witten, his security blanket underneath. And what was nice for Dallas, and I'm curious to get your take when you watch it, you finally see the highly touted rookie that they had such lofty expectations for coming the season, Michael Gallup, getting into the offense. If he can emerge and at least be a viable receiving threat from a raw talent standpoint, he might be the only guy on that Cowboys roster that can do some special things. So an interesting game for sure Sunday night. But as we mentioned, Payne, with the good, the bad, and the ugly come the gruesome, and there were some marquee injuries that are definitely worth discussing.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
He joins us every Monday here on the Bet the Board podcast. There is nobody, and I mean nobody, in the industry better when it comes to trying to assess all the injuries you've seen for their gambling and fantasy implications. You can follow him on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. He was a team doctor for 17 plus years. He's got all sorts of great information on his site. And Dr. Chow, you know, you get a tough job in all of this. Payne and I watch these games as sports bettors. You have to go out there and try and assess some of the carnage we see week in, week out.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to keep track. I mean, thankfully, we're into some bye weeks where, you know, we're not going to have 10 games all at once sometimes and end up jumping around, and to the point where sometimes I don't get the feel of a football game anymore, trying to assess injuries and go back and look and so forth, because it's just hard to keep track.
I was going to say, it's got to be a lot more difficult than watching the games through a very different lens than sports bettors and fans alike are able to. And I feel a natural place to start is what unfolded in Arizona. Earl Thomas, we know about his contract dispute coming into the season. And you had an interesting tweet about the refracture of his tibia. You care to explain and expand on why he may have been more prone to injury than he otherwise would have been in the past?
Absolutely. And I am not at all critical of Earl Thomas for his decision not to have surgery. I'm not critical of any doctors that were involved. But after his first tibia break in 2016, he apparently was allowed to heal without surgery, which is a good thing. And it's natural to want to not have surgery. However, medically, especially with Pete Carroll saying it was related, obviously it was the same side. And obviously it was a bad luck hit on his leg, but it wasn't the worst hit in the world. The chance of refracture is a little bit higher without having a rod put down your tibia. And in my experience, when we do in the NFL put a rod down someone's tibia, like Tyler Lockett, a teammate of his had, you leave the rod in until your playing career is over and then pull it out unless it's bothering you in some way. So that's just a side effect of this whole thing. But the good news is that, you know, obviously he's done for this season and he's not going to come back. But coming up for free agency, I don't think this is disaster in this way. As a team physician, assuming he had it rotted, assuming x-rays, CT scan if necessary, showed it was healed, I wouldn't really downgrade him in terms of free agency, in terms of his health. Obviously, a GM's got to decide what to pay him, but I really wouldn't downgrade him. And if anything, and I always try and look for a silver lining, you know, he's worried about wear and tear in his body. He's going to save the wear and tear. So I don't know what the financial marketplace will be, but I think his medical health, despite the pain and the rehab and so forth, is probably going to be okay.
So that's good news. Some positive thoughts there for Earl Thomas. When we transition to the offensive side of the ball, and Dr. Chow, this is going to sound like the same question week after week, but these quarterbacks are just so impactful to the point spread. We make adjustments week to week. And I want to start with Marcus Mariota a little bit here. I watched this game. It was clear, at least early on, Vrabel was going to take some shots and try to open up space and signal this message to the Eagles defense that you better respect us deep. The balls were a little wobbly, but during critical points, there was a stretch there where Mariota was 14 for 14. And I think to the casual fan, Mariota looks great. But how close to 100% is he? And if he's not, how long until that time?
Look, mad respect for Marcus Mariota and Mike Vrabel. If anything, you know, this is one part that I paid a lot of attention to where I think, you know, I got a little bit of the feel of the game. And you're absolutely right. Look, the Titans obviously are not dumb. They know what Marcus Mariota is dealing with. I can see it from afar. And if I can see it from afar, they know it from the inside. And guess what? There was a game of film on Marcus Mariota now where his average per pass attempt was 5.8 yards by design. And the Titans knew, the Eagles knew it too. That's why they took two shots down the field. One was a little overthrown and complete. One was a little underthrown but complete right on the first get from the get-go. And that established the tone and sort of called off the dogs of coming up closer. And I think it changed the tone of the game. Marcus Mariota still has his weaknesses. If you look at, you know, trying to run a two-minute drill with, I think it was under a minute left at the end of the first half, trying to force the ball down the field and drive the ball. It's not so much his long throws where the accuracy gets off. Sure, that's harder than short throws. But it's whenever he throws, tries to really throw with max velocity, that's where the grip becomes an issue. And that's kind of what he was doing, you know, driving the ball down the middle of the field, overthrew it at the end of the first half and got his one interception. However, if you look at the final touchdown, which he got in overtime, what a great job there. Not only the call by Mike Vrabel to go for it, but, you know, the receivers getting wide open. And, you know, that was an easy floater pass. It's still going to be a little bit before he's 100%. He is clearly getting better each week. And Mike Vrabel and company are doing a great job covering for him. And Marcus Mariota is doing a fantastic job playing through it. But he's still not there yet and probably won't be for a couple of weeks. But, hey, the wins keep coming.
Yeah, huge win for the Titans for sure. And another quarterback I inquired about with some possible fatigue, Andrew Luck. Is there an issue with fatigue potentially rearing its head again at some point this season? Like, you know Luck's situation. Would you have him on some type of pitch count, so to speak, where you wouldn't want Luck throwing more than a certain number of times per game or this season? And I watched the game. I know the situation called for it, but 62 pass attempts this week. He's on pace for 744. Is that kind of workload worrisome for you?
Well, here's the deal. In my experience, let's say Andrew Luck were put on a pitch count. Let's say he was, and they said you couldn't throw more than 40 passes a game. In my experience, once you get in the game and once the doctor has cleared him, and, you know, as you just said, it's what the game dictates. The coaches aren't really going to follow it. You can try and get him to follow it, but if it push comes to shove, I mean, you know, what power are you going to have to, as a Colts team doctor, to tap Frank Reich on the shoulder and say, you know, we had agreed on 45 throws. He's at 46 now. And that's just not reality. Now, obviously, if there was like something for sure where if you hit 50, his arm would blow up, then you would have to, but it's just all relative. As far as fatigue goes, that's what we talked about a little bit before and some last week. I wasn't making a big deal about not throwing that Hail Mary. Certainly, Luck is probably still getting stronger and stronger in his arm, but he's got an NFL arm, and all the talk last week, I wasn't really worried about. And this week, what is it, 40 for 62, 62 pass attempts, 464 yards, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions, 108.5 quarterback rating. I mean, and he threw 2 Hail Marys. I mean, I think those questions are dead. But in answer to your question about fatigue, The good thing about football compared to, let's say, a baseball pitcher who is more on a pitch count, obviously where the word was developed, is that A, you're throwing off the mound, and B, the majority of your pitches are near maximum velocity. Whereas in football, you're not throwing off a mound, and the majority of your throws are not anywhere near that maximum velocity. Of course, the hazard of football is different arm angles, can't always step in the throw, footwork, and you get hit. So it's a little bit different. But it's not quite the same as in baseball. Oh, boy, if you start off with 125 pitches in a start, you might need extra rest and the whole deal. So not quite the same parallel in terms of fatigue.
Positive news there for Luck. And when we look at a guy like Carson Wentz, based on what you're seeing at this moment on the field, does his recovery timeline for being 100% seem sooner than that initial thought of week 9 or 10?
Yeah, you know, he is on. Look, once again, he's another guy. Remember the ACL and LCL. Forget the fact that he wasn't ready week one. He's been playing now and done a fantastic job so far. He's more athletic, I think, still than 80% of the quarterbacks that are out there right now. But the crazy thing is he's still going to get better in terms of what he can do.
Absolutely. And when I look at the running back position, Leonard Fournette, he's dealing with the hamstring. It seems like a constant problem. He missed 2 weeks, came back, re-injures it early on against the Jets. I wouldn't envision the Jaguars bring him back until he's 100% this time. If that's the case, how long until we see Leonard Fournette again?
Well, you know, obviously there were reports of just tightness in the beginning, and he went back in the game before they pulled him. And, you know, obviously we've talked about before tightness and sometimes cramps are code words for hamstring strain without really saying it. And it depends on how bad it is. But you're absolutely right. I don't see how he realistically plays next week. And the hope is he can play the following week or soon thereafter. And here's why. If it's a significant aggravation, it's going to be a while. But even if it's minor, think about it this way. You're right. They already got bit once. Are they really going to put him back in again next week and get bit twice, besides being, you know, a manpower issue with the 46? But the setback issue, you know, it's the old fool me once, right? And now fool me twice kind of thing. And I think it's going to be a little while before he's back. And you're right about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one last one before I pass the baton back to Todd here. Rob Gronkowski dealing with the ankle issue. Didn't appear to the post-game press conference. Any issues there, do you think?
Well, I didn't see any particular injury on video. Obviously, they were working on the ankle, and there were some antecedent ankle issues coming into the week. So I can't give any exact details, and New England isn't exactly the most forthcoming team. But, you know, obviously everyone's going to talk about the short week and the short turnaround here. But you never know here. I mean, the hope is it's a low ankle sprain and he can get taped and he'll keep going and play through. He's obviously played through a lot of injuries. I think we'll have to look at some practice reports and see what's going on. But a little bit of question mark that needs to be worked out here, but not overly concerned about something big.
Two other tight end injuries as well, Dr. Chow, that came out, and it looked one definitely season ending as Tyler Eifert had some heartfelt words for all the fans and the support, a guy who's clearly struggling to just stay on the field. And then also with the Seahawks, an up-and-coming tight end with Will Dissly. What did you happen to see from both of those two injuries?
Well, Tyler Eifert has an ankle fracture dislocation. It's the type of injury when you get rolled up from behind, the reason why horse collar tackles are outlawed. Now, he was not horse collared. It was a legal tackle. It just was bad luck in how it happened. And it is the good news with Tyler Eifert is that it looks worse than it is because the ankle stayed out of place. You know, it's never good when the knee points north and the toes point east, and it didn't self-reduce. But it's actually the same injury as Odell Beckham had, and obviously he's come back and been fine. The hope is and the expectation is Tyler Eifert will as well. The one thing that I would have to say to fans and people is don't tell me that Tyler Eifert is injury prone. He has had a lot of injuries, but what does this bad luck football injury have to do with anything else that he had before in football, be it his back or any of the other issues? I don't think that does. I mean, it was a good football play, and it was just bad luck, and those things happen. As far as Will Dissly is concerned, I mean, number 88 tight end for the Seahawks is not good luck. I mean, that's his number, and that was Jimmy Graham's number, and when he played with the Seahawks, and they both now have patella tendon ruptures. And that is actually a harder rehab than ACL tear. And it just, the patella tendon is three times as big as the ACL, and the rehab is harder. So he's done for the season. He's got a chance to come back in 2019. He's a young player, but that's just a horrific injury on a pretty simple and innocuous play.
He is the best in the business. You can follow him on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. One of the best in terms of game day, getting you ready from a sports betting and fantasy perspective. Encourage everyone out there listening to check out his podcast as well at ProFootballDoc.com. Dr. Chow, can't thank you enough. This segment makes all of us smarter every single Monday throughout the season, and look forward to chatting with you again same time next week.
Absolutely. One final thing is Kenny Vaccaro, safety for the Titans. He dislocated his elbow, walked off the field like it was nothing, and then I tweeted a picture of it. It sounds horrible, but he'll be back in 2 to 4 weeks. And I've never had this before, but I had a handful of other current NFL players talking about it, because I said, this is one tough dude who can do this. And three or four guys retweeted and said, you have no idea. He's like the toughest guy that we've ever seen. So I thought that was interesting that current NFL guys were backing me up on how tough Kenny Vaccaro is.
That's pretty impressive, Dr. Chow, because Payne tries to get out of podcasting when he's got a hangnail. So clearly we need that, some of that Kenny Vaccaro toughness around these Bet the Board offices.
Sounds good. Let me know.
You know, Payne, I wasn't kidding with Dr. Chow. I mean, you playing through hangnails, you not having enough lip balm or whatever the hell else you need to get yourself in the right state of mind. I mean, you're one of those guys that feel where everything has to be perfect for you to hit the playing field and give us 100%.
I don't know about that.
All right.
Possibly.
Well, I mean,
possibly.
I wasn't sure if you're from that, look good, feel good, play good school of thought.
Deion Sanders?
Exactly. I figured you knew.
Feel good, play good, play good, pay good.
It's the name
of the
game.
Live good.
it is the name of the game to try and be able to go through. But like everything else in life, all of us are truly day to day.
You're so bleak. Who says that?
You know, it's every
now and
again.
You're the ultimate pessimist.
You know what? I've gotten a lot better about it. I don't want you to give me the ultimate pessimist. I've gotten a lot better. When we started this podcast 4 years ago, I was probably even more miserable to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So I've tried to gradually get better, clear my mind, let things that aren't going to bother me in 5 years only bother me for 5 minutes. So shut your mouth over there.
Since you're not sure you'll make it, who knows? You might not be able to finish this podcast. Maybe live a little today. Have a slice of pizza.
I'm not going to go that far. I did have a hamburger last night. I went out to watch the Steelers-Ravens game, and I had a burger last night, which is not consistent with my football diet.
Oh, man. Guys living the life. How do you have a social life during football season?
You know, your work done. Every now and again, you have to break away for a few minutes, clear the head, came back, started to get to all my work, make sure that we were properly positioned to provide this deep analysis of what we saw NFL week 4. So it's a half hour there, half hour there. I don't go on the all night benders that you I might have did some point in my life, at least not during football season.
Yeah, you're changing. You're changing.
So, yeah, I'm an old man. I'm happier to be asleep on the couch by 10:45 than I am sitting in a booth at a nightclub at 4 a.m. But all right. We have one game left on the docket, and it's a Monday Night Football game between the Chiefs and Broncos, Payne, and we've seen some movement towards the underdog. Right now, it is the Kansas City Chiefs, a 3.5-point favorite at betonline.ag. Total in this game sits at 54.5. We know the headlines, handicapping Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs lead the league in offense, 39.3 points per game, 13 touchdown passes for an NFL record, 9 different receivers have caught touchdowns. What have we seen from Patrick Mahomes to lead us to believe that he's going to continue some of this success maybe about 12 hours from now?
Those are all great numbers. And I think at this point we know Mahomes has been outstanding. And for me, it's not just the wow plays he's making, right? Like, we all had a concern coming in about Mahomes valuing the football. That hasn't been an issue to this point. And when you look at the tape and you look at the All-22, like, there hasn't been dropped interceptions or defenses not taking advantage of his mistakes. They're simply just Mahomes isn't making them at a rate that we thought he would to this point. clearly, like, you know, Patty and Andy Reid are on the same page right now. You mentioned all the records that have been broke. If this performance continues, the Chiefs are going to have a shot at being one of the top five most efficient offenses in NFL history. You know, we've seen this, though, before with Andy Reid, like, especially the last few seasons, where, like, his offense, it hits a lull. We talked about this week one on the Look Ahead podcast or the Monday Preview podcast. Not sure which one, but it's like he's had to hand over play calling duties to a Doug Peterson or a Matt Nagy. So that could still be in the cards week five or six like it's been the last few years. If you are looking at like the schedule of defenses the Chiefs have played, not very good, right? Like Chargers, Steelers, 49ers. That's one of the easiest schedules of opponent defenses like in the NFL through 3 weeks. So let's see what it looks like when you step up in class a little bit. And we might have that here tonight.
Well, and you mentioned the Broncos defense. Clearly, we know what Von Miller's capable of doing, wreaking havoc off the edge. The rookie Bradley Chubb has produced pressure on 19% of his pass rush snaps, the third highest rate ever recorded by a rookie edge defender with at least 50 snaps. Chris Harris is good in the secondary. But Payne, that's my biggest concern. Aside from Chris Harris in that secondary, Denver's looked very beatable on the back end. And Kansas City isn't just a one-trick pony now with Tyreek Hill. They have some other guys more than capable of taking the lid off a defense.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mentioned the slight upgrade in opponent defenses with Denver. They're certainly doing a good job stopping the run. You know, number one in rushing success rate defense. Every time an opponent hands it off, averaging just 3.3 yards per attempt. But it's the secondary that's been just a mess for Denver. You're looking at some of these numbers. 25th in passing success rate defense. 51% of passes have graded successful. The Broncos are giving up big plays, too. 27th in explosive pass defense. Like, it's a real concern for this defense. And when you consider Vance Joseph, like, he's a defensive guy. He has been known to be an elite secondary coach. So this is a real issue when your head coach, the team's worst identity, is something that your head coach is supposed to be phenomenal at. You mentioned Chris Harris. You know, sure, he's been good, like, this season, but, you know, compare it to like what he was doing previously, like there's been a downgrade there. When you compare like his career to his current level, it's okay. Like he's not a bad player by any stretch. That's not where I'm going with this. He's above average. But when you lose Talib in the offseason, like Harris has to get back to playing an elite level.
What have you seen enough from the Broncos defense to lead you to believe they can do some things from a unique perspective to confuse Mahomes? They'll, of course, be the first team to see Patty for the second time. I don't want to put a whole lot of stock in Week 17 where Mahomes was in the game and then came back to lead the game-winning drive. But they've at least seen him up close and personal. They know about some of the speed and some of the tools he has at his disposal.
Possibly, but I'm going to venture to say no. And one thing in doing some reading, Patty Mahomes came out this week and was like, hey, that was week 17. We weren't putting a damn thing on film before the playoff game. So they saw me at a vanilla clip and he was pretty adamant about that. Said, hey, we went in there, we beat them and we'd showed absolutely nothing. So if you believe him, then this is a Broncos defense that basically just has three games of tape on him, a couple preseason games. They're going to have to figure out the secondary. And I think the biggest thing here is you're looking at the Broncos offense. Like they're going to have to keep pace. If you're going into this game or any game against the Chiefs and saying, hey, we're just going to completely shut these dudes down, it's just not going to happen. Now, there's certainly a level that you can bring them down to. I think at this point, even if the Chiefs offense is above average, they're going to have trouble winning games because the defense is so poor.
Well, and you mentioned the Chiefs defense. We know they've been flagged 16 times through three games, putting them only behind the Steelers and 49ers. Missed tackles, 36 of them so far, has them last in the league. But what I found interesting, Payne, for their yards per play defense where they struggle, their inability to tackle, they're still the number one defense in the league when it comes to getting off the field on third down, holding their opponents to about a 26% clip.
Yeah, it's because the opponent offenses are forced to play catch up and pass. So there's a lot of those situations where it's third and long. Listen, the reason I am monitoring the Chiefs offense so closely, and this is kind of why I wanted to go in this direction, it's because this defense is a mess. Like, there's not a lot of talent. That's why there's those missed tackles. There can't be a dip in the Chiefs offense because this stop unit is just putrid. And like right now, when you look at some of these metrics, certainly like a team does this okay, a team does this, like average. This Chiefs defense as a whole are horrific. And it's really, when you look at the Chiefs as a whole, positive 0.1 yards net per play. And it's because his defense can't stop a nosebleed. You look at all the important metrics. The Chiefs defense can't stop the run. 52% of rushes have graded successful. They can't stop the pass. 51% of passes have graded successful. They also give up explosive plays, running and passing. 26 of them through three games. Now, if you're a Chiefs fan or an optimist like me and not you, Todd.
I was waiting for that dig. Well played.
I think
dick.
If you want to just be like a complete Chiefs homer and an optimist, you could go down this route and say, listen, the defense has faced Philip Rivers, Big Ben, and Jimmy G. And I think if like all 32 NFL franchises were drafting quarterbacks at this point, those three are probably being drafted in the top 10 this season, I would think. So they've faced a tough slate of opponent offenses, a tough slate of quarterbacks. So maybe the Chiefs defense can improve some.
So I want to ask you about this, Payne, because I know every now and again we talk about trends and a lot of this is nonsense and noise. It makes for good radio fodder and for headline grabbing stuff. But when you look at the Broncos that are 2-12-1 against the spread over their last 15 games, they're 4-12-1 against the spread within the division, and Kansas City's won 5 straight over Denver by an average score of 30-19. What do we take from the way the market is valuing the Broncos and it more just that, hey, people are perceiving this team to still be very good defensively and they've been unable to live up to expectations? Or do you just feel it's a blip and it's a short enough sample size that you can't read anything into it?
That question was so long and my brain is so small, Todd, I don't even know what the hell you just asked me.
The fact that Denver has struggled so much against the spread, not only in all their games, but in the division as well.
Right. And listen, when these teams prepare and build their rosters through the draft, through free agency, they're building to face opponents within their division because that's the easiest path to the playoffs. So you're finding opponent weaknesses and you're drafting. You're looking at weaknesses that other teams in your division exploit and you're drafting to fill those needs and holes because, again, just win your division, you make the playoffs. When you look at this Broncos team recently, why they're so poor is I think we saw them coming off elite status, right? Winning Super Bowls with Peyton Manning, and then all of a sudden the market can't catch up to what they currently are without him. Now, you could throw a trend in the other direction. We know how good this Broncos team is, and I was going to say in September, but I think the calendar rolled over to October.
It is officially October 1.
But early in the season, it's kind of the same thing, right? You could make the case, well, the Broncos are fantastic early in the season because of altitude and teams not being in shape with the new CBA. So it's like when you look at all these trends, it's like I could paint one in one light and you could paint one in another, and it's just you need all the metrics to kind of incorporate into what's really going on here. When you look at this game specifically, I remember the look-ahead line before the season even started was Broncos -1. Last week, it was Chiefs -3. We got up to like 5, 5.5 this week. Professional money is clearly on the dog here. It could tick back up to what, maybe 4, 4.5, just because sportsbooks are going to just have a ton of liability on the Chiefs here. But it becomes one of those games that we talk about now in 2018. Do you want the team that can pass, is explosive through the air, or do you want a Broncos team that might have a little bit better defense, can run the ball potentially a little bit better and play keep away? The latter, you're going to have to play perfect football. You can't make mistakes. When you have the Chiefs offense, you can get away with a few mistakes because they're good through the air and they're so explosive. And we know at this stage in the game in 2018, if you can win the passing battle, it correlates to wins 4 times greater clip than running the ball.
How dare you denigrate Case Keenum and that high-powered Denver Broncos offense led by Demaryius Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders, and a cast of other characters?
It needs to be high-powered. That's how they need to attack this team. Like, if you think you're just going to come out and you're going to be down 14 and have Case Keenum chuck and play catch-up, like, it's not going to work. From the onset of this game, the Broncos offense is going to have to be aggressive. Sure, implement the ground game, keep the clock running, but you can do that with short, efficient passes. You can pass the ball on a screen. You can pass on early downs, pick up 5, 6 yards. It's efficient. The clock keeps running as well. Keep that Chiefs offense on the sideline. But there's been an internal battle, and I've talked about this at great lengths. Bill Musgrave and Vance Joseph are battling right now. They're butting heads. Vance is a defensive guy. He wants to play ground and pound. Musgrave wants more tempo. He wants more passing on early downs to help Case Keenum out. It feels like through this point in the season, through 3 games, Vance wins early on. It becomes slow early on, and then all of a sudden, hey, poof, the light comes on. It's like, hey, we need to play catch-up. Here comes the tempo, and the offense seems to hum a little bit.
Look at you getting all fired up. And with that impassioned pain so diatribe, I have to ask you this. Do you think there's enough value or an investment worth making on the Denver Broncos tonight?
I am not playing the Broncos. I have not played them yet at this point. It would certainly intrigue me if it got back to 4.5. And then I have talked to some math guys who feel completely opposite. Said, hey, if you sharp guys keep pounding this thing down and I can lay 3, I might consider doing that. Certainly a similar situation to what we saw with the Giants and the Saints this week. When it got to 3, there were some math guys who said, hey, I might nibble here and lay it a little bit. Let's see where this line goes. At 3.5, I really don't want Denver. But again, 100% the most respected side at 5 and 4.5. We're kind of sitting here at 3.5. This could go either way. I think this has to tick up, right?
You would think with some of the liability and a lot of the recreational bettors not getting to the window yet, trying to take their windfall of riches from a weekend that went the public's way in the National Football League to try and parlay it into some Monday night success. I would echo those same sentiments. I think we see a 4 pop, maybe even a 4.5 at some books known to deal more to recreational customers as well.
And again, like, you know, not that we're talking a ton of correlation here when a total's at, you know, as high as it is, but there has again been some sharp money on the under. I'm not going that route, but that would correlate more towards Denver than it would Kansas City.
Should be an interesting game, no doubt, as we continue to learn more and more about the Kansas City Chiefs and their prospects. Patrick Mahomes, the odds-on favorite at betonline.ag to win the MVP after 3 games, just tells you how much publicity and how much buzz they have around this offense. But Payne, I think we've done enough damage for a Monday morning. Any parting shots before we reconvene to talk some pro football same time on Thursday?
That's it. Let's get out of Dodge here before the construction kicks up another notch.
We will do just that. Special thanks to Dr. David Chow. You can follow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. He'll join us every Monday throughout the course of the NFL regular season. For Payne Insider, follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And, of course, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. Best of luck with Monday Night Football between Denver and Kansas City. Hopefully we'll see you at the window.